So we get the announcement, and I want to invite you over the course of the next few weeks to mourn and celebrate too. It's both are perfectly appropriate and make sense. And we grieve the imminent departure of a man and woman who we've grown to love and care for and who we will not soon forget. But we also celebrate the amazing job that Dan has done in the last 9 years, shepherding this church from where it was. And if you've been here, you know we've come a long way, baby, from 9 years ago to where we are today, which is a church much more ready, I think, for the next stage of our evolution as an integral part of the body of Christ in Hollywood. And we are, you know, we occupy literally and figuratively a crucial place in this city. And Dan's departure will not affect that. It will not affect the crucial role that we play here as a church. In fact, I actually believe that Dan's leaving will aid us in this transition. Because if you think about it, if God truly is calling Dan and Ann to Santa Rosa, then he intends for someone else to take his place, who will be an even better fit for us through this next transition. As hard as that may be for us to imagine, that's what we have to literally believe. And I'm not saying anything that Jesus himself didn't already say. When his disciples heard that he was leaving, they freaked out and were disoriented and sad and angry and wondered, what the hell is going on? What do you mean you're leaving? How could you do this? And he basically said in Aramaic, chill out, relax, I'm leaving, yes, but I'm leaving you with someone even better, the Spirit of God, who is your advocate and friend, and with him you will do even greater things. And I think the same is true of Dan. Dan has served his purpose here wonderfully and beautifully, and it's been fabulous, and we need to fet him like no other. But we have to believe now as a church that someone even better is going to come, who's going to fill this particular space in the church that's crucial and important. And so we can be excited about that. So we enter into this season of the church with both sadness and celebration and gratitude. We're grateful for all that Dan and Ann have done. And we can be immensely grateful for all the work and excited for the next step. And one of the other things that we learned in interim training too, you don't have to go to interim training to learn this, obviously, but one of the things you learn too is that anytime a beloved pastor leaves a church, it's always a wonderful reminder of who it is we actually worship. And we worship Jesus, not Dan Baumgartner. And Jesus never leaves. He never has goodbyes. We never have a going away party for Jesus. That would be a rather odd thing for a church to do. So we are in this interesting, unique, but good place in the church. And, you know, it's like the prize fighter, right? You want them to leave on top. You don't want to be kicking them out in order to go. We weren't even close to getting there with Dan. So it makes sense. When I first got the news, I was disoriented and shocked and couldn't believe it. But now that I've had a chance to think about it and pray over it and reflect on it, it makes sense to me. It makes perfect sense. So this will be a very interesting and exciting time. And Jordan Turner and Joel will need our extra support and love and encouragement because the associate pastors are the ones who get it the hardest. Because they're the whole staff too, Bethany Corey and everyone, you know, they're the ones who, it's most difficult for them. Because not only is their pastor leaving, but their boss, their mentor, their many other things, and they're left to kind of pick up the pieces and kind of hold it all together. So please keep Jordan and Joel particularly in your prayers and Courtney and Bethany and the whole staff because they have to just kind of hold it together. And it's really, really crucial that we support them through this transition period. There's going to be an interim pastor who comes in at some point when the presbytery deems it appropriate to call an interim pastor in consultation with the personnel committee of this church. And he or she will be called in, and they won't know this church nearly as well as Jordan and Joel do, and probably even some of us. And yet they will become the head of staff. And so we have to transition with them through that as well. But thankfully, you know, we have some fabulous, I mean, and again, thanks in great part to Dan's leadership here, we have wonderful, wonderful people in place, not only Joel and Jordan and Bethany but I mean, you think of the Lord's Lighthouse, you think of the Actors Co-op, you think of the various Sunday schools around here, And, you know, we've got a good base of folks here. And Dan's leaving the church in a much stronger place than when he found it. And he's leaving it in a strong enough place that he can go now. And we will, you know, just love him to death until he leaves. But we will not freak out. It's going to be fine. It's going to be okay. In fact, I think that this next transition of the church, which will have its own challenges and rewards, will be shepherded by someone who's being called here even now. We don't know who that person is. They may not even know who it is, but God already has in mind someone who's going to come here, and it'll be just the right fit. So we can be both excited for that and sad to see Dan and Ann go. And now to the Tower of Babel and our last Sunday in the primordial history. We started in August. It's April. We've made it finally almost out. Just one more class, and then we get into more of sort of actual biblical history and the story of Abraham, and we'll probably spend a year on him. So what we've been saying this whole time from the beginning and up until now is this theme in the primordial history of life and death, life through death, death to life. This is how it works. This is how God created it to be, in this perfect balance, in a sort of cosmic symmetry of life and death, a mysterious sort of divine two-step, ebb and flow, birth that leads to death, death that leads to rebirth, and so on. Until we get to the final consummation of Jesus' return, which is the final consummation of creation when Jesus comes back. I had a wonderful and really interesting email exchange with one of you this week. And there's this misnomer among many people in the church that the Garden of Eden was sort of the final kind of act of God. Like, this was the best of all worlds. That's not a biblical position. It was the beginning of what was going to become the best of all worlds. Eden was just the beginning. Eden was never meant to be the final consummation of God's creation. It was just the beginning. The final consummation comes at the end. It's what we pray for in the Lord's Prayer. But I think we unintentionally distort the purpose and importance of creation by suggesting, oh, it was this perfect world, and this was the final intention, because you have to recognize that the Word was with God, the Word was God, and the Word was with God from the beginning, and the Word is Jesus Christ. There was always this intention. And both always this intention and always this intention that Jesus was coming back, that somehow God in his foreknowledge knew and understood that at some point all hell would break loose, that this is what happens when God creates something outside of himself. That thing is less than God. And if it's less than God, then it's something other than God. It's something that's not perfect. It's something that has the potential to fall apart. But God creates us in our image, or in his image, he creates us. But we're just an image of that. We are not God. So by the very act of creating, God extends himself, but also leaves himself vulnerable. The very act of creation, and anyone who's a parent knows this, that when you have a child, you are 1,000,000,000,000,000 times more vulnerable than you were before you had a child. When you get married, you're 1,000,000 times more vulnerable than you were before you got married. It just happens. And so as God creates out of love, he makes himself intentionally and deliberately more vulnerable, because he knows now that this thing, anything could happen at this point. And God chooses to love. And in order for there to be love, there needs to be two wills. If there's only one will, it's not love. It's something entirely different. God would simply objectify us, and we would be objects. But to make us subjects, to make us actually people, there needed to be a will, but it would be a will less than perfect. And a less than perfect will is what led to our situation. So Jesus, when he comes back, that's the final consummation of creation. It's not Eden. Eden's not the final. Eden was the first step. So now allow me to read from the slightly less animated and interesting actual story of the Tower of Babel from Genesis chapter 11, 1 through 9. This is for you, Dad. Shout out to you. All people on the earth had one language and the same words. When they traveled east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them hard. They used bricks for stones, and asphalt for mortar. They said, come, let's build for ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the sky. And let's make a name for ourselves so that we won't be dispersed over all the earth. Then the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the humans built. And the Lord said, there is now one people and they all have the same language. This is what they have begun to do. And now all that they plan to do will be plausible for them. Come, let's go down and mix up their language there so they won't understand each other's language. Then the Lord dispersed them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, it is named Babel, because there the Lord mixed up the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them all over the earth. So we left off last week with the first part of the story of Babel and the idea that a person can be damned in one of two ways. By taking away what he or she needs, and that heads off in one direction, or by giving a person everything they want, which heads off in the other, but both end up in the same place. And so you can be damned either through abject despair, which leads to cynicism, which is just habituated anger, or you can damn yourself by being left to your own desires, and it's just you get whatever you want whenever you want it. We can be damned through poverty or privilege, pessimism or presumption, Africa model or America model, as I'm sort of saying it, right? You can be damned in both ways. And this is precisely what we find, I think, in the story of Babel. Humans were getting everything they wanted, and that little piece of dialogue from God seems to say it, doesn't he? He says, now they have the same language. This is what they've begun to do, and now all that they plan to do will be plausible for them. There will be no limits. They can do whatever they want. And he realizes that this is a problem, because the last time he gave people the chance to do whatever they want, it all went to hell. So now he needs to figure out what he's going to do about this, God does. And humans were getting everything they wanted, but our desires, right, had already been distorted by sin. We knew this. Even at that sort of creation 2.0 after the flood, and we were effectively a sort of a new creation. Nonetheless, we were a contingent people, and our desires were contingent. And you know how one bad decision leads to another bad decision, and then leads to a whole continent of bad decisions? That's kind of what happened with us. That it just was one bad decision after another that eventually we get to Genesis 6 and 7, where everything goes wonky. So our desires had already been distorted by sin, and left to their own devices, our desires would always eventually introduce chaos into the world. Left to ourselves, if we are left to ourselves, eventually everything will go to hell. If we are left to ourselves, everything will eventually fall apart. We will become our own worst enemy. We have seen the enemy, and the enemy is us. We, if left to our own devices, I mean, it's the same thing with leaving a five-year-old by himself. The five-year-old may be a perfectly good kid, raised in the church, Sunday school, Christian of the year, like my wife got one year. He may be wonderful, terrific person, but leave a five-year-old long enough and everything will go wonky. Everything will go haywire. Leave humans alone long enough, and everything will get into trouble. And this is Romans. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the degrading of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. Therefore, God gave them up to their desires. And this is what happens in any situation in Scripture where God gives us up, where he lets us go. We are given our freedom in this text as a judgment. Isn't that interesting? The very freedom we want ends up being the judgment that basically we cast down upon ourselves. And in this sense, we effectively create our own realities and our own problems. If we choose against God and do not acknowledge his blessings, much less his existence, we accept a reality without him or his blessings, which then serves as our reality and as a judgment upon us. Upon, you know, it's sort of wrought upon our so-called free will. And I find that fascinating, that God allows us to create our own realities. Now, you know, I think you do, I think we talked about this, that I don't believe in free will. Didn't we cover this in class? Have we talked about this? Just either shake your head or nod. Yeah, sort of? Yeah? We did. Okay, yeah, basically. So good, I don't need to explain myself. So we, you know, this, our so-called free will, which has never been free, our free will now becomes our judgment. Now, I mean, now it's like having no checks and balances, you know, on the stock market. Just do whatever you want. Just let capitalism run free. Well, the only way that works is if people aren't inherently sinful. But of course, they take every institution and make it bad. That's what the definition of human beings are. We may do some pretty amazing things in the meantime, but so here we are. It's so interesting to me, and I've thought about this more and more and more in the last few months, how God allows us to accept, in some sense, our reality, if I can put it that way. So again, here's a way I'll say this. In some sense, the atheist ultimately gets what he or she wants, or says they want, or what they believe in, which is a universe bereft of God. There is no God. Okay. Well, that's what, in some sense, that's what your reality tells you. That's what life, in some sense, will begin to feel like. In the Russian Orthodox tradition, it says that outside the Trinity, there is only hell. There's nothing outside of the Trinity other than that. Which doesn't mean that a person who doesn't believe, or a person who's agnostic, who doesn't care much, or doesn't really know, and doesn't really care to find out, it doesn't mean that their lives will be miserable by any means. Not at all. I don't mean to suggest that. All I'm suggesting is that in some ways, God allows us to create our own realities. So this is the reality. In some sense, there's this kind of giving them up to their desires. Oh, okay, you want a world without God? Oh, that's what you get. But believers, on the other hand, get the reality that they believe, one in which God is shot through creation and is involved, however inscrutably, in our everyday lives, and we can turn to God and we can pray for his help, and we can lean on him, and we can understand that he mourns with us through life. So I don't mean to suggest that objectively there are two realities. I don't mean to suggest that at all. There is only one truth. But in some sense, you get this from Romans. You get it even, it's interesting, even the passage last week that Dan read from about Lazarus. There's, in a sense, two realities, isn't there? I mean, Lazarus did die. And Mary and Martha were beside themselves with grief over his death. That's one reality. And they were just like, this is it. If you had been here sooner, he wouldn't have died. And then Jesus is operating with two realities. He's like, well, he didn't actually die. I mean, yes, he, right? Yes, he's dead, but he's sleeping, but really, but no one who sleeps develops a stench like that. So he's dead, but not dead. And then Jesus cries. Well, why are you crying if he's just asleep, Jesus? Because Jesus is dealing in two realities, too. And we see this in Nicodemus, the story of Nicodemus with Jesus, where Nicodemus is like, what? Like, I have to go back in my mother's womb? That doesn't make sense. And Jesus says, no, oh my gosh, if you don't get this, you're not going to get that. There are two realities that are constantly contending with us, or maybe even more than two, right? And there is this sense in which when God gives us up, which is the worst possible thing that can happen. And in the story of Babel, there seems to be, in some sense, almost two realities going on again. And Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann, probably my favorite Old Testament scholar, has this to say about Babel. The nations, Noah's descendants, are restless with their status as subjects of Yahweh and recipients of Yahweh's gifts. And there's the story of Babel. They crave autonomy. As a consequence of their rejection of the status as covenanted, blessed, promised subjects of Yahweh, the nations who were authorized by Yahweh now are scattered, and the coherence and unity of humanity irreversibly violated. The nations are made to receive scattering, exposed displacement, just as Israel's worst negation is the scattering from which it is always being gathered or synagogued. In the process of this recalcitrance, the blessed state of the family of humanity has been transformed into a circumstance of vexation, alienation, and jeopardy. Walter Brueggemann accepts this sort of dual reality. Like, you know, the real thing, Israel, is that I am your God and you are my people and I love and bless you, but you will not accept that. And so look what you've done. You have created another reality for yourself. You are now living in a world of vexation and alienation and jeopardy when it doesn't have to be that way. There is another reality here. But I'm not a micromanager, God says. I step in when I choose to step in, but I'm always there. I never abandon you. And note the theme here. I think this is so interesting and I think appropriate to us. The people of God crave autonomy. They want things done their way. They get the gift of freedom from God, and they want instead autonomy. Freedom isn't enough. They want their own way of doing things. They want their own autonomy, not realizing that their freedom is actually tied up to their obedience. That's what makes them free, is their obedience to God. When they choose not to obey God and sort of do their own thing, they actually become imprisoned in their own desires because their desires and ideas and thoughts have already been distorted by sin. And so we've talked about this paradox a number of times in this class, that the more they're obedient to God, the freer they become. But the people of God are like, no, our freedom isn't enough. We want autonomy. And they don't understand that freedom is tied to obedience. And I think often we don't understand that either. They see the blessings of God, his blessings, right? His intentions were to make them a people that he loved and that he wanted to bless, and that they were people of promise. And they take those blessings as a cumbersome shackle to break free from. We don't want that. We want to do it our way. We don't need. And I think to myself, well, this sounds familiar to all of us because we've all been teenagers. This is sort of the story of the teenage years. This is the adolescent years of the Judeo-Christian tradition. We're like, no, we want it our way. We want to do it our way. We want not just freedom to stay out until 11 at night. We want autonomy to do whatever we want to do. And so it's a very interesting, we revisit this sort of place over and over again. But let me add a little historical, cultural context to this biblical narrative, because I don't want to stray too far from the Tower of Babel itself and this event. What did this happen? Did it really work like this? Is this kind of what went on? And the Oxford Companion to the Bible says this, and it's very interesting to me. Building the tower is interpreted as an act of arrogance. And human history is here understood to take a decisive turn from a common thread to many strands. The enormous ziggurats of Mesopotamia could easily have symbolized the presumptuousness of the urban elite and their ruin, the judgment of God. Even as ruins, their massive dimensions would have been striking. The Sumerian temple tower of the moon god Nana at Ur could have been the model for the Tower of Babel. The huge terraced mountain of brick with the God's temple on top was built circa 2100 BCE. Of similar construction, the great temple of Marmaduke in Babylon, the Isagila, is possibly for the referent of the Genesis narrative. According to the Babylon epic Enuma Elish, it took a year just to make the bricks for this colossally high structure. I just want to point out that there is anthropological and archaeological evidence for this story. That this idea that there was this sort of human presumption as soon as we gathered together in cities. And you know, the valley that we read about in the actual Babel story, Shikar, is actually the name for Mesopotamia. So, and Mesopotamia, archaeologists tell us, is where human civilization began. So this story comes out of a historical narrative. It's a historical consciousness. And these ziggurats that we have evidence of were these massively tall towers. And so the people of God could easily have used that as their referent. We were building these incredibly tall towers. We thought that we could become gods ourselves. We thought that we could be autonomous people who kind of become gods ourselves, who run our lives, and we don't need help from anyone else. Other scholars, like Bernard Anderson, who is also, he's written probably the main textbook on the Old Testament that most college students use in any Old Testament classes. Bernard Anderson sees the scattering of the people after God comes down and sort of passes judgment upon them. He actually sees it as a blessing, not just a judgment, but an actual blessing. And I actually see this too. It's both. Just like God's expulsion of Adam and Eve from the garden, it was both a judgment upon them. They could not, okay, fine, you've been grounded, like literally. You're out of the Garden of Eden. But it was also a blessing that God expelled them from the garden because he didn't want them to eat from the tree of eternal life. Then they'd live forever with the knowledge of good and evil. They'd live forever in a guilty state. They weren't intended to ever live forever. That wasn't the idea. They weren't made immortal. And so that expulsion was a blessing in the same way that Bernard Anderson is suggesting that this sort of confusion of language and the birth of culture was in itself a blessing. And the Valley of Shinar, which, as I mentioned, is ancient Mesopotamia, is the etymology here is fascinating. Babel is just the Hebrew word for Babylon. So Babel is Babylon. That's what it means. That's where we get that term. And Babylon, as we discussed last week, its original meaning was the gate of God. So this dispersing, what appears to be a curse can actually be a blessing, given that this expulsion prevents us from worshiping ourselves and having a too lofty view of our own status. And God had seen this before. He had seen it happen. He knew what would happen. And so he has this conversation with the Godhead. And he says, we can't let this happen again. We can't let this happen again. I promise there would be no more flooding of the entire world. I can't, that sort of judgment I will not put upon the planet, but I'm simply not going to sit idly by. It's always the same, it seems, that what finally gets us in the most trouble is when we take divine matters into our own hands. That's where we get into the most trouble. That's where we have huge problems, is when humanity has a too high view of itself. And anthropocentrism, this idea that we're sort of the center of the universe and the center of the world, invariably leads to a demotion of us. By lifting ourselves too high, we become mere animals, because then we become slaves to our own instincts and desires. And we won't allow God to break into our lives. We simply will not allow it. Even if we know it might be better for us, we want our autonomy more than anything else. And so we take divine matters into our own hands, whether it's in the form of seeking ultimate knowledge or ultimate power or ultimate status and importance. And you might see the correlate of this in the modern day in the hydrogen bomb or cloning and eugenics or the worship of celebrity. We are at our worst, generally, when we are at our most grandiose. That's when real trouble hits. And interestingly enough, it's often when we are at our most vulnerable that quite often the better angels of our nature come out. So when we're at our best, we're actually at our worst. And often when we're at our worst, there's a good chance we might stand the chance to be at our best. Obviously, there's always the Lord of the Flies element. When we're at our worst, we're also at our worst. God spares the people of old from this self-imposed curse. And so the nations are scattered and languages are born. In fact, in my Common English Bible, from which I took the text, this section is entitled, and the editors of the Bible put it in, Origins of Language and Cultures. This was our ancient forefathers and mothers' explanation for why there were so many languages. And we were consorting with ourselves. We were conspiring against God. And I want to look now, just before I leave it completely, I want to look one more time, and this is sort of the last idea I want to end with the story of the Tower of Babel and with our primordial history. But this idea of God's leaving us to our own devices as a curse. God saying, oh, you want freedom from me? Which is a contradiction in terms, but is that what you want? Okay. how we misapprehend the blessings of God as a cumbersome shackle to break free from, where we desire autonomy and not just freedom. And when God grants us such, it becomes a nightmare. I want to unpack this for a minute. The first thing I want to say, though, and this is crucial, is that we also know that as much as God may leave us to our own desires for a season, he never does it purely out of spite, like some sort of, you know, forsaken lover. Like, oh, fine, you don't want me? Well, then I'm, you know, to hell with you. God will leave us for a time, but he'll never abandon us. And sometimes he leaves us for a time. There's a term for this in the vocabulary of sanctification called the dark night of the soul, where we literally feel abandoned by God, which Jesus experienced on the cross. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you abandoned me? My Father, why? So we can experience subjective abandonment. And Martin Luther talks a lot about this notion of just being, feeling completely. But God may step back. God may leave us for a time. In fact, we know that he does. Romans 1 is an indication of this. That God can take a step back. But he never stops loving us. He never gives up on us. He never abandons us. And so we need to understand that there's this always this dynamic. And again, isn't it interesting? Don't we see this in human relationships all the time? Where sometimes a stepping back may actually be the best thing for someone. As you're raising a child, every parent struggles with this. How far do we step back? When do we step back? For what reasons do we step back? Because you can't always just hover. You'll raise a sociopath. That's all you do. You have to step back and be like, oh, I can't watch. I can't watch. You know, you tell your spouse, you look. I can't see. I can't look. And invariably, because they're learning and growing up, they'll screw it up. They'll make mistakes. And then you'll think, oh, we never should have given them freedom. No, that's just the way it works. Hopefully they won't make the same mistake again the next time. But you see God in this. He's a living God, and he says, fine, you really, is this really what you want? I've seen it in my own life. There was a stepping back period that God was kind enough to let me experience. There really was. I really sensed this God stepping back. Like, all right, Brunner, have at it. And so I had at it. And I came to the end of that season of having at it and realized, well, that's not that fun. Huh, that was weird. Okay, well, I guess, you know, if that's the best the world has to offer, that's not much. So now I can go back into the fold like, you know, the prodigal son who went out and tried his thing and didn't quite work out. So he comes back to the father, whole new person. And I think God grants some of us these prodigal seasons. And so there is this stepping back. So I want to just make that clear that he doesn't abandon us in spite of appearances to the contrary. Even to those who reject God, God remains at the door knocking. It's not as if an atheist decides, well, I don't believe in God. God is dead. And God's like, oh, well, that's a bummer, and walks away. No, God continues to knock. He doesn't barge in with a battering ram. He just knocks. He just knocks, and he waits. He won't allow us, finally, I think, in the end, to damn ourselves entirely. He may leave us to create our own realities for a while. He may step back for a time, but because of his love for us, he remains Emmanuel, God with us. But what does this look like in practical terms? I mean, what is this? How might this look for us? How can God both leave us and not leave us? How can God give us up to our desires and yet be Emmanuel? Now, I'm operating on sheer speculation here based on my own experience and things I've read. But I wonder if the effect of God leaving us might come in the form of his not stepping in to affect our lives if we ask him not to. If we simply just don't include God in our life. Maybe there are periods where God says, okay, you know, for their sake, I will let them learn the hard way. You know, Flannery O'Connor talks about this. She says that some people literally have to be knocked upside the head because they're so stubborn. And this is what happens to all her characters. You do not want to be a character in a Flannery O'Connor story, just saying. But, you know, some people just need to get just backhanded They need to be like, fine, all right. And that's me. That is I. I'm a Flannery O'Connor character. It's probably why I like her so much. I had to just get backhanded. And so there is this sense in which he leaves us honoring in a sense, our desire for autonomy. Oh, you want to be autonomous for a time? Fine. I mean, he did give Babylonians time to build the tower. He didn't stop them when he saw the blueprints. He didn't erect a fence around the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I mean, it wasn't like God was sleeping one day and he woke up and he's like, oh, crap, she grabbed the apple. He watched it happen. And he was probably shaking his head like, I can't believe it. I can't, don't, no, don't, but, oh, you bit it. Adam. You see this sense that he'll give us up to our own desires even when those desires go wonky. They go nuts. And sometimes that's precisely what drives us to our knees. And this is, boy, I tell you, you can work out, I think, a pretty interesting and robust theology of theodicy, this idea of a perfect and good God allowing evil to happen. God is not a mercurial, hateful deity who just likes to see us suffer, but God knows that sometimes suffering is the only thing that teaches us. Now, this doesn't explain all the suffering in the world. That would be a cheap shot, and I don't mean to suggest that. But it does explain some of the suffering in the world. And there is a sense in which, now God's, you know, plan isn't over. It's far from done. But this ebb and flow, this give and take, this stepping back sometimes and then entering in is a significant element of the history of human civilization. That it is based on desire. That it is based on desire. And as much as I think, you know, that there are theologians around who, and this has all kind of been the rage a lot lately, James K. Smith writes a lot about this. We need to baptize our desires. We need to form our desires in the right way. And I, as I've said in this class before, I think he's starting off on the wrong foot. Our problem, if I can distill it down to one thing, our problem is our desires. That's kind of the point, is that we've taken our desires and let them rule our lives. So we desire new clothes, well, then we'll get them. We desire a new spouse, well, then we'll get that person. We desire, some of our desires, I don't mean to suggest that all of our desires are terrible, not at all. Some are wonderful and laudable and good. But in the balance, our desires almost always get us into trouble. This is why they're called virtues, right? Because we have to work at them. Virtues by themselves are not desires. That was essentially Plato's and Aristotle's whole project was how do we cultivate the virtues so they become the thing we want? And this is what James Smith is working with, too, and Augustine to some degree. Augustine was that boy. He was, I mean, talk about desire, right? Have you read the Confessions? His whole life was just crazy with desire. But he got to this place where he realized that what life should be based on, and this was God's whole intention, is not desire but service. That we understand the meaning of life not through the lens of desire but through the lens of service, which is love. Love, if I can put it this way, is the desire to serve. I don't like putting it that way. Love is serving. See, what we've done, I think, is we've turned our wants into our needs. When what we should have done is turned our needs into our wants. What the Christian life is really about, what any life with integrity is really about, is taking what you truly need and what others need, I mean really need, and making that your desire. But what we've done is just the opposite. We've taken all the things we want and we've made them the things we need. So we catch ourselves, don't we? And I'm sure you all have caught yourselves doing this. Oh man, I need another outfit. Well, actually, technically you don't, but you want another outfit. Oh, I need another pair of shoes. Well, no, you just want another pair of shoes, right? That's what we've done. And so left to ourselves, we'll eventually even distort love as something based on desire. This is what we've done with love. We've turned it into something we desire. But that's not what love is. Now, does it have that element of it? Song of Solomon, right? We know it. It does. It's wonderful and it's beautiful. And it's this beautiful picture of this husband and wife loving each other. And that sort of nuptial imagery there in Hosea kind of tell us about the relationship between God and us. But isn't the whole point, I mean, this is, I think, St. Teresa of Avila, God, I don't want you. I don't even want you, but I want to want you. At the end of the day, it finally isn't about what we want. It's about what we need. And I don't know about you, but I'm old enough now to be able to say with no reservations, I'd rather live a life getting everything I needed than everything I wanted. In fact, a life getting everything I wanted is my definition of hell. And you see what we've done? As a culture, we've turned hell into heaven. That's why we all want so much money, so we can get what we want. We don't realize it's actually, the secret is, it's just the opposite. I'm not going to extol the virtues of poverty. That's not what I mean, but here's the problem. When you live in a world where everyone can get what they want, no one really ends up getting what they need. So the imbalance is just profound. But I want to get back to this idea that we've distorted love. This is such an important point that I'm going to do an extended quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Life Together. And this is what I'm suggesting, is that we have created a Tower of Babel of love, of desire, and we've mistaken it for actual love. And then we've called it a virtue because we've called it love. Bonhoeffer. Likewise, there is human love of one's neighbor. Such passion is capable of prodigious sacrifices. Often it far surpasses genuine Christian love in fervent devotion and visible results. It speaks the Christian language with overwhelming and stirring eloquence. But it is what Paul is speaking of when he says, if I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Human love is directed to the other person for his own sake. Spiritual love loves him for Christ's sake. Therefore, human love seeks direct contact with the other person. It loves him not as a free person, but as one whom it binds to itself. It wants to gain, to capture by every means. It uses force. It desires to be irresistible, to rule. Human love has little regard for truth. It makes the truth relative, since nothing, not even the truth, must come between it and the beloved person. Human love desires the other person, his company, his answering love, but it does not serve him. On the contrary, it continues to desire even when it seems to be serving. There are two marks, both of which are one and the same thing, that manifest the difference between spiritual and human love. Human love cannot tolerate the dissolution of a fellowship that has become false for the sake of genuine fellowship. And human love cannot love an enemy, that is, one who seriously and stubbornly resists it. Both spring from the same source. Human love is by its very nature desire, desire for human community. So long as it can satisfy this desire in some way, it will not give it up, even for the sake of the truth, even for the sake of genuine love for others. But where it can no longer expect its desire to be fulfilled, there it stops short, namely, in the face of an enemy. There it turns to hatred, contempt, and calumny. Right there is the point where spiritual love begins. This is why human love becomes personal hatred when it encounters genuine spiritual love, which does not desire, but serves. Human love makes itself an end in itself. It creates of itself an end, an idol which it worships, to which it must subject everything. It nurses and cultivates an ideal. It loves itself and nothing else in the world. Spiritual love, however, comes from Jesus Christ. It serves him alone. It knows that it has no immediate access to other persons. What love is, only Christ tells in his word. Contrary to all my own opinions and convictions, Jesus Christ will tell me what love toward the brethren really is. Therefore, spiritual love is bound solely to the word of Jesus Christ. Where Christ bids me to maintain fellowship for the sake of love, I will maintain it. Where his truth enjoins me to dissolve a fellowship for love's sake, there I will dissolve it, despite all the protests of my human love. Because spiritual love does not desire, but rather serves, it loves an enemy as a brother. It originates neither in the brother nor in the enemy, but in Christ and his word. Human love can never understand spiritual love, for spiritual love is from above. It is something completely strange, new, and incomprehensible to all earthly love. This is the dynamic that we started the class with. Human love is upset at Dan and Ann for leaving. We can't believe they're leaving us, and we're sad, and that's legitimate, and it's okay. But spiritual love is the love that celebrates the fact that they've been called to another church. What a blessed church that is. And it celebrates the fact that God has someone better in mind for this next stage of our journey in this life, in this church. Spiritual love and earthly love are always battling with each other, always. But earthly love will never love the enemy, because earthly love is based on desire. Spiritual love is the only love that can love an enemy, because spiritual love is centered in Christ. If we try to love someone and we mistake it for a feeling, it won't work. But if we love someone out of service, and I mean that service can take the form of eros, it can take the form of philos, where you're loving. But you know, when you choose to serve someone out of love, then you are living the love that God has called us to. And I would imagine then that the hope, and Lewis talks a little bit about this, particularly in his Great Divorce, where there's one of the people on the bus is talking about the love of his mother. It is a strange and twisted love. But when we understand that love is service, and we read this in 1 Corinthians 13, and Kierkegaard understands this so much, that love is never deceived and believes all things, because it's a spiritual love. When we understand love that way, then we recognize. And when we try to make that our desire, if we can mold the things we need into our desires, that can become what it means to live a life after Christ. But we've built up for ourselves as a human community a Tower of Babel of love. We're in a matrix of our own making. The levels of distortion that have been laid one on top of the other until it reaches the heavens has trapped us in this sort of weird simulacrum, right? It's like a kind of Truman Show of our own design. A tangled web of social contracts, false altruisms, false virtues, all of them separated from the one true source of all love and virtue, Jesus Christ. So what does that look like? Well, it looks like us sitting at a Starbucks with a friend, drinking $4 cups of sugar spiked caffeine-induced water, surrounded by people in business suits and yoga leotards and Gucci bags, off to their offices or gyms or studios, either to make widgets, whose only function is to serve the needs that we ourselves have created, or to get their bodies to rebel against the very sedentary lives we asked for in the first place. That's what this complex matrix of weird, distorted love, that's what it looks like. Assumption piled upon buried assumption ad nauseum, desire upon human desire until it's all we know and it's all we understand and it's all we see. And then we find ourselves in the midst of betrayals. We find ourselves in the midst of huge disappointments. We find ourselves doing things that no real thoughtful person would ever in his wildest dreams consider doing. And we've normalized it, because we've forgotten spiritual love. And I'm reminded again of those haunting lines from Rita Dove's poem, All Souls. Now that change was de rigueur, man would discover desire, then yearn for what he would learn to call distraction. This was the true loss. Already the din was fading. Before them a silence larger than all their ignorance yawned, and this they walked into until it was all they knew. In time, they hunkered down to business, filling the world with sighs. These anonymous, pompous creatures, heads tilted as if straining to make out the words for a song played long ago in a foreign land. That's the human condition. And that song that we're trying to make out is spiritual love. We know it, we sense it, we feel it, but God has to save us from ourselves. Okay, 10:30. I ended on time. Any questions or comments or thoughts or ideas? Yeah. Yeah, well, sometimes love is a big damn interruption. That's the thing, I think. You know, it's a great way to put it. You know, it reminds me of that that saying from Rainer Rilke. Who is this Christ who interferes in everything? Who is this Christ who's one big damn interruption? Well, yep. That's, I mean, I think actually it probably was meant to be both. Right? That love is sometimes just one big damn interruption. But what we've done, of course, as I've already said, is we've turned it into silly little love songs. And we've turned it into, we've just become trapped in the matrix of our own desires. And we're so confused and so convoluted. Every once in a while we catch a glimpse. We see it. Aha, I see, okay, right. But then we lose it in the cacophony of what we call civilization, culture. And I think it's made more poignant in some ways because we live in such a hyper-capitalist society. Hyper-capitalism, right? Which is a distortion of whatever virtues capitalism itself may have. Certainly that's not what we're living. It's and so we've taken our desires, and of course, right? We all know this, a desire left to its own devices becomes an addiction. That's just what it becomes, because it becomes a desire for its own sake, and then the more we feed off it, the hungrier we get. So that then real true love becomes one big damn interruption. And you know, that's the thing. You'll get a situation where you know, a husband or wife may find themselves in sort of an intractable place. Something has to happen. It's not happening. This, and if love is based on desire, then it's like, well, lights out. See ya. Peace out. We're done. But if love is based on service, then it's like, okay, now we have a new reality. How are we going to work this out? Let's figure this out. It's not what I would have chosen, not my desire, but how does this work? Same with friendships. Same with, you know, and so I think we, and I think, you know, again, our primordial history, which we started out in August or September talking about, is the story of our origins. And our origins, where, I mean, it's hardwired practically into our DNA that we lead with our desires. And I think the challenge, as we are praying to God, not my will, but your will be done, may your will become more my will. That's just a fancy way of saying, may your love become my love. May the things you love become the things I love. And may I love in a way that you love. I mean, that's basically what we're asking, isn't it, when we pray? Is, Lord, help me to be more like you. I mean, can you imagine? And this is what I maybe, you know, when God talks about his love for us, it is a passionate, intense love, but it also is one based on service. It is a passionate desire to serve his people and to love them and to bless them. And by golly, even if they don't want to be blessed, I'm going to bless them anyway. But every once in a while, he's like, fine, you want me to sort of not bless you? And it takes all of his to step back. But he sometimes thinks maybe that's the best thing for us. And so I think we just have to reanimate how we understand love. I mean, ultimately, that's kind of the understatement of the week, but we have to reanimate our love for each other. It has to be something you want to serve. Yeah, Alicia.
It's just a thought, but I'm in a world where I'm constantly like discipling my kids.
Yep.
And so I see this overemphasis on honoring the desire of people, and the way that a lot of times we're interacting with
Love it.
And I think, like, even as we're discipling children, intentionally encouraging them towards service is one of the ways that we help them overcome. Because there's a higher cost of just their own desire, you know, that you don't do things
right.
Just for yourself. You do things to serve
others. To serve others. And I think, for those of you who couldn't hear, Alicia was saying that you know, just to have a strong-willed kid, as you know, isn't a virtue in itself. We want to mold that will. We want to guide that will. I think this is one of the reasons that when Arabelle was first introduced to the Lord's Lighthouse, we weren't sure what she'd think. I mean, she was 8 or 9 years old, and we thought, you know, you're going to be in a room with 200 homeless people, and they can say things that may freak you out sometimes, or they may look a little odd. I mean, I didn't know. And I think even Belle didn't fully understand after the first time. She was sort of like, that was so unbelievable. I want to go back every week. I want to do the Lord's Lighthouse every single Sunday. And we were like, no, your mom and dad aren't that virtuous, honey. We feel good about once a month. But you know, I think when we get that taste of what real will is, the true will, which is the will to serve, that's how God created us, was he actually, I mean, the blueprint for humanity is that we are to serve each other in love. That is what it means to be human. And you see it when you start to think in those terms, you start to realize, oh, that's what is meant by don't think of others less than yourselves, but think of them more highly than yourself. And the greatest love a person has for another is that they lay down their life. I mean, over and over again, like an incantation, it becomes, this is the point. We're supposed to serve each other in love. And sometimes we understand that service means taking a step back. It could very well mean that, for example, because we're allowing a person to live in a hateful way, either towards us or towards others, and so we need to back off. This is part of discipling kids. We need to back off sometimes and let them make some mistakes and let them learn. But ultimately, love is always, and this is how M. Scott Peck puts it in his book, The Road Less Traveled. Love, finally, is the commitment to the other person's spiritual growth. That's ultimately what love is. Is you do whatever you can do to nurture a person's spiritual maturity. That's love. I mean, and this is it's one of the best-selling books of all time. This guy's brilliant. He's a thoughtful man, and he had counseled thousands of people, and he'd really tried to get under, what is this thing called love? And that is the road less traveled, is that you realize, you figure out, aha, it's not about having my desires all met. It's about having my needs met and becoming in touch with what I need more than what I want. And that's what it means to live a full life. That's the point. And then to will that for yourself and for others. That's what it means. All right, thank you all. And we'll start with Abraham next week.